your car.
You need the VIN.com. So easy you can do it in your underwear.
City streets or small towns, everyone deserves a clean, green community. We are Keep America Beautiful, the nonprofit working to end littering, improve recycling, and beautify communities. Let's do beautiful things.
WSBN Washington. ESPN 630, the sports capital. Washington's new home for sports. This is the Andy Pollin Hour. On Washington's new home for sports, ESPN 630, the sports capital.
Gone for two today. Tony Kornheiser taking a Friday off. I think it's probably related to the Masters. He loves the Masters, and they've been playing his clip all the time on ESPN radio and I think on TV as well, where he said on PTI that this is the start of spring where everybody feels good again. And Tony loves golf. He's been to the Masters, and I'm sure he's camped out and watching as Justin Rose with a, let's see, he had a bogey on his first hole, so he has dropped now to 6 under par, but still has a 3-shot lead on Mark Leishman, and we'll keep an eye on what's going on over the next couple of hours. It's a lot different now with the Masters in that, you know, you can check on your phone what's happening with the scores. Having done radio for over 40 years, that was a big deal to give you the Masters leaderboard. That's the only way you could know what was happening. You'd have to tune to the radio, and now it's very accessible. Mike Callow's here from the Bram Weinstein Show. You're not much of a golf guy, are you?
Not really, but I still pay attention to it enough, yeah.
Yeah. Just like the Nationals opener the other day, it just feels good that it's early April and the Masters is being played. They have a gallery. It's a smaller gallery, but it's getting back to feeling more and more normal. Now, you do feel the absence of Tiger Woods in a big way, not just because Tiger isn't on the leaderboard. There have been plenty of Masters where he hasn't been a factor early on, but you're always watching him. You always want to know where he is. And the updates have been, you know, so-and-so is up by 4 shots on so-and-so, and Tiger Woods is 12 shots off the lead. You don't give that about anybody else, but about Tiger. So his absence is there. And actually, there is an update that came out in USA Today on the Tiger Woods accident. They have obtained a 22-page collision report on this. And the document showed that there was an empty pharmaceutical bottle in his backpack at the scene. Now, you know, I'm sure he was taking pain medication, so, you know, whether he emptied the bottle before the crash, who knows, but that's just another element of this story. Also, data from the vehicle's black box recorder showed the golfer was driving in a straight line before a small amount of steering input registered late in the wreck sequence. Had Tiger applied his brakes to reduce his speed or steered to correct, he would not have collided with the center median and the collision would not have occurred, according to a report prepared by the LAPD. When the accident happened, there was no evidence that he attempted to hit the brakes. He suddenly pressed the gas pedal. They said 99% in the final moments before hitting the raised media. So that does indicate that he thought it was the brake.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't hit the gas pedal 99%. But it's, you know, it's just more troubling information from all of this. And when he was interviewed, now this is not unusual because I can tell you from my own experience when I had a concussion in a bicycle accident a little more than a year and a half ago. I didn't really know where I was. It happened on a Saturday, and I had just in the last couple of months before had left a job where I was working Saturday mornings, and I said to people in the hospital, how come I'm not working?
Right.
So he thought that he was in Florida when they interviewed him just after the crash when he became conscious. So I don't know if this goes anywhere, but that's a very, very scary thing that he's in the process of crashing and he hits the gas pedal to the floor almost and collides with the tree at 75 miles an hour and lived. So there's your Tiger update.
It also does you too, Andy, when you're, you know, you got a nice rental car too. Sometimes you got to get used to that as well. That could have been a factor as well. It wasn't a car you was regularly driving. It wasn't the everyday car.
Right.
So,
and the question always becomes, why is Tiger driving? Tiger was driving because Tiger likes to drive.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And I remember Steve Zabin telling me this when Tiger had his tournament at Congressional And when it was over, and Zabin had been out there doing broadcasting, and he was on the Beltway heading home, and he looked to his left, and there was Tiger heading to the airport with other people driving the car.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're that famous, to do something normal like that probably feels good. And I remember seeing an interview that Michelle Obama did when she was still in office with the president. She said the thing she was looking forward to the most was driving her own car. Just because of security reasons, the president's wife is not allowed to drive anywhere. So you kind of understand that. Another update that I just saw, the referee, Bert Smith, who collapsed on the court during the Gonzaga USC Elite Eight, turns out that probably saved his life.
Wow.
He's 56 years old. He's in great shape, 6'3", 195 pounds. He works about 90 games a year. And you can see when they're wheeling him off the court, he's got his arms crossed because he's angry. He told the doctors that he wanted to walk off. And they said, no, we're not taking any chances. They strapped him onto the gurney, and they took him out. And they got him to the hospital, and they found that he had a blood clot.
Oh, wow.
And they said, with these kind of things, you don't know where it's going to travel next and what it's going to do. And had this not happened in the way it did, it's possible, you know, this could happen later in the game when you're winded and running up and down the court and you collapse and die. And I saw it in real time. I was watching it live, and you can't be my age and not think about Hank Gathers.
Yeah.
Hank Gathers in 1990 was a player for Loyola Marymount, and he had a heart condition for which he'd been taking medication, but the medication made him a little bit lethargic, and he decided that he was going to stop taking it, and they're playing a conference tournament game, and he collapsed on the court and died at the age of 21 or 22. And so I was certainly thinking that, but as it turned out, it was a blood clot, and they were able to take care of it with blood thinners, and he's okay. So,
good. You
know, that was kind of lucky little break there. Baseball. Baseball and instant replay. Count me among those who say, I think you still have to have it. But I can understand the camp that says, well, yeah, but it doesn't always work well, and more it's slowing down the game. You know, we had baseball for 140-some years without it. You know, what do you need it for? I'm still a replay guy. Are you?
Yes.
I am, too.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
But we had something yesterday which makes the anti-replay people stand up and say, ha-ha, well, look at this. And having had a partner for many years who is anti-replay, I've had this argument many, many times. But I'm still going to stick with replay. However, we had the Mets playing the Marlins yesterday. It's a home opener for the Mets. Tie game, bottom of the ninth, one out, bases loaded. Michael Conforto is at the plate. 2-2 count. Anthony Bass is pitching for the Marlins. Throws a slider right in the zone, and you hear Howie Rose, who did the game on radio, say, yep, strike three there. And you also hear Gary Cohen. You're going to hear this full little clip here from the game. This is Gary Cohen, Keith Hernandez, and Ron Darling. They think it's a strikeout too. Game over. Hold everything. That's not the case. Here's how it sounded on SNY with Cohen, Hernandez, and Darling.
1-2 coming. And the slider in there. Strike three.
Hit him.
To get out of the way. It was a strike, but he didn't move. And Don Mattingly is going to come out and argue the call with the home plate umpire, Ron Culpa.
The ball hit him, and it was going to be a strike.
Yep.
So the Mets are celebrating. The Marlins are arguing. And unless this is overruled, the Mets have themselves a 3-2 win as Conforto is nicked by a pitch. Now, by rule, you have to make an effort to get out of the way. And that's what the Marlins are arguing.
This is a strike,
and
he gets hit. Look at that. Oh, you can't do that.
They have totally got a case.
They got to bring it back.
Totally have a case.
They're going to.
It's absolute.
He stuck his elbow right into that pitch.
It's going to be strike three.
The umpires are conferring, and let's see.
Now, the hit by pitch is reviewable.
The umpires are leaving. Or are they
going to the headset.
I don't think they can go to the headset on this. This is not a reviewable play.
Well, hit by pitch is reviewable. Why can't you say hit by pitch in the strike zone reviewable?
I don't think so. I think whether he is hit or not is reviewable, but it's a judgment call by the umpire as to whether he made an effort to get out of the way.
We're trying to get it right.
Can't do that.
I'm almost certain that
you couldn't call a strike.
That they cannot overrule this on replay by saying that he stuck his elbow into it.
No, but you can call it that he stuck his arm in purpose and he's out.
Yes.
You can call that on a review, but the umpire can call that.
What are they calling it? What are they saying?
They're saying the play stands. Game's over. The Mets win it.
Wow.
That's
Michael Conforto clearly stuck his elbow into it. And Mattingly's coming out and arguing, but I'm sure he's going to be told that that's not reviewable.
But you're trying to get it right. They don't get it right. So why even have replay?
Well, you can understand the indignation from Darling. He was a pitcher. Good for them, though. They're the hometown announcers, and they called it right. Now, here's the rule book on this. Anytime a batter is hit by a pitch that does not swing at it is a hit by pitch, except when one of two caveats apply. A, the ball is in the strike zone when it touches the batter, which is the case here, or the batter makes no attempt to avoid being touched by the ball. And you can see Conforto's got one of those big elbow pads that Barry Bonds used to wear. He's a left-handed hitter, so it's on his right arm. And you see him stick it out there just enough to get clipped. And you can actually, if you listen closely, you can hear the ball hitting the pad. And I guess it's because of the way that is written, it's so ambiguous that they just were not able to use replay to make the right call. There should be a common sense clause in replay, right?
Yeah, that, you think so?
Yeah, if replay to me should be a tool. It should be a tool to say, let's get it right, and we're going to use that to see if we made an error. But the rules are written out so specifically that you can't use it in situations, which, you know, goes back to the Dez Bryant play. Was it a catch? Wasn't it a catch? Well, you know, it looked like a catch. And if you look at it on replay, it appears to be a catch. But, you know, because of the way the rules are written, they had to say incomplete, and it cost the Cowboys a playoff game, which, you know, it's not upsetting to me, but understand. Major League Baseball does not sanction replay to review any other aspect of a hit by pitch. So that's what they did. Now, the umpire, Culpa, at least to his credit, talked to a pool reporter after the game and said the guy was hit by the pitch in the strike zone. I should have called him out, which is what they should have done, but they didn't. So.
And what I don't understand here, this is actually the perfect scenario for you blew a call. It was the end of the game. Could actually, in the rule book, no, you can't go to it. But this is actually one of those cases where you can go right back to the scenario and say, we're going to pick it up from right here, or you call them out and game over, or whatever the next scenario would have been.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was put in because of egregious calls that have been made. Don Dechinger made one of the most egregious in the 85 World Series, which cost the Cardinals the World Series. Yeah. The runner was clearly out. We had forget the name of the pitcher for the Tigers 6-7 years ago, maybe it's even 10, that's how time passes, but cost him a perfect game. The runner was out by three steps, and it was not reviewable at the time.
Look at Max Scherzer's first no-hitter. Remember, it should have been a perfect game, and that Pirate, I forget that guy's name. But the Pirates guy leaned into it,
exactly.
And everybody was going, no hitter's great, but he almost had a perfect game. He's never going to have that opportunity again, most likely.
And then we have, and I was thinking about this, and I looked up the details on this when I heard about it, 1999, July 25th, 99, Orioles are playing the Angels at Camden Yards. And you should actually look up the video on this, Mike, because you're a big uniform guy. The baseball tried this. Fortunately, they haven't gone back to it, but they tried turn ahead the clock on uniforms.
Big fan. Huge fan.
You're
of those.
A fan of this?
Because of how just egregious they were. Yeah, don't get me wrong. They have not gotten better with age, but I love the concept of those. Yes.
You would. Okay. So I obviously, as an older person, hate them.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember even the Ken Griffey was playing then.
Oh, yeah. Seattle's are like, they go for thousands on eBay these
really?
Days. Yeah.
And I think he was allowed in the field to wear his hat backwards. You know, and I thought, this looks ridiculous. Anyway, they're wearing these ridiculous uniforms. And Bell has had a monster game. Bottom of the first inning, Orioles down 3-0, hits a 2-run homer. Bottom of the third, Orioles down 4-3, he walks left stranded. Bottom of the fifth, Orioles down 7-3, singles to left, stranded. Bottom of the seventh, Orioles down 7-3, hits a 3-run homer up the left field line. Bottom of the ninth, Orioles trailing 7-6, Bell hits a 2-out solo shot to tie the game. So they go to the 11th inning, and Hasegawa is pitching. I won't even attempt his first name. Mm-hmm. Hasegawa is pitching for the Angels. At this point, Bell has hit 3 home runs. You're not going to lay one out over the plate
course,
for him.
Yeah.
So he pitches him high and tight, and it hits him in the shoulder. Bell is having such a big game that he says to the umpire, forget about it. No. He says,
No, it didn't hit me.
It's okay. I'm good. And the umpire points him to first base. And Bell begins to argue with the umpire. And so Ray Miller has to come out of the dugout because if the game continues on, he certainly doesn't want Bell thrown out.
Right, of course.
And they have to negotiate with Bell to go to first base that he thought that he could actually turn it down. And Bell says, and I don't know if the broadcast picked it up, but he said to Hasegawa, just throw the MFing ball over the effing plate.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And Bell was one of baseball's biggest hotheads.
Yeah.
And so he finally walks to first base, and three batters later, Cal Ripken Jr. hit a single to left, and B.J. Surhoff scored the game-winning run. But, I was thinking about that. And so we had the opposite of this. And I guess, you know, with all this, you know, it was just a regular season game, though it was the Mets' home opener. Umpires are going to be on the lookout for this, I suppose. And also, with these big arm pads, shouldn't they be able to do something about that? Shouldn't they? If a guy has a legitimate injury, okay, he can wear a brace.
Sure.
But this is body armor here, which is made for the specific purpose, it seems, for something like this.
Yes and no, I think. I think we've seen it, though, where a guy gets hurt at the plate and it affects him, obviously, defensively. Like, look at Trey Turner when he had the messed up thumb or the index finger. last year or 2 years ago.
And he wasn't wearing a big brace on his hand.
He wasn't, but I think the reason why guys have him on their elbows and their wrists and everything is to protect him from that. I'm with you, though. There's got to be kind of an NHL goalie rule here.
Right.
It can only go so far above your skin, and if it's jutting out and the ball hits it, you're not hit by the pitch, something like that. There's got to be – they need to consult the NHL on this one and kind of get their rules on it.
You just can't hang your arm over the plate and say, I dare you.
Right.
And then and then lean in like the way you did. The other lean that I was thinking of was the Reggie Jackson one in the World Series. I think it was 78 when he was on the base paths. It was against the Dodgers, and there was a throw to first base, and he jutted out his hip to knock the ball away, which allowed the Dodgers to score a run. Again, no replay, 1978. We have replay now. Replay not effective in this case, yes. as Ron Darling, the former pitcher, said, well, then why have replay?
Yeah, right.
Which can lead you to many arguments on sports radio and hours of entertainment, which we won't do here.
And at least here locally, Andy, at least game one, it did benefit the Nationals. Remember they called that Braves a home run, and it wasn't. And even the fans are going, it was past the pole, and they end up, you know, switching it, and Soto walked off the game. So as bad as this one was, at least we here locally have gotten a call that went our way.
And I remember the first year of the Nats, the chief, the relief pitcher, the closer, Chad Cordero. Yeah, I was at a game where he was pitching against the Braves, and there was a ball that clearly hit off the foul pole as a home run.
Yeah.
And Frank Robinson went out to argue and won the argument, which you almost never see.
Wow.
And on replay, it showed that the ball hit the foul pole and should have been a home
run.
It was,
yeah.
But was not. Yeah. And Cordero got another save. Just there it goes. Coming up, Ron Rivera is everywhere. Ron Rivera, if you call Ron Rivera at home, he'll talk to you. He's doing everybody's talk show. He was on with Rich Eisen the other day. And a couple of stories. One, he's setting the record straight again on Alex Smith. And his story about John Madden is a good one. It's the 85th birthday of Madden. And there's some more good stories to throw into the mix as well. We'll get to that and more. It's the Andy Pollin Hour. Mel Kiper Jr. in 1 hour here on ESPN 630. Don't go away.
The Andy Pollin Hour on ESPN 630, the sports capital.
And for Tony Kornheiser today from 11 to 12, 11:20, we talked to Mel Kiper, the GOAT of draft coverage, the godfather of it all. I think this is draft number 43 for Mel, but we'll ask him when he comes on at 11:20. Ron Rivera seems to be the most accessible coach in the NFL. He's like on Dan Patrick every week.
Yeah,
he's been on Rich Eisen three or four times in the last few months. Maybe it's to make up for Dan Snyder. I don't know. But I can't remember not just a coach here, but a coach anywhere being this accessible. Can you?
Not only accessible, but accessible to the masses. He's been on Good Morning America,
yeah.
What, two, three times since he's been hired? I mean, it's right. And not only that. After big stories have come out that aren't exactly positive in the team's light, he's been asked to go on the shows and done them. It's shocking, honestly.
Well, part of the Good Morning America thing is the cancer that he beat,
which is
you know, that's understandable. But I'm just talking about general yak shows, and Rich Eisen's podcast is in that group, along with Dan Patrick, who does his show, and Colin Cowherd, and national people like that.
Yeah.
So he was on the other day, and Eisen asked him about the ending of the Alex Smith situation, where Alex Smith indicated that, you know, things weren't all that smooth in his departure. And here's what Rivera said.
There's really not much to talk about as far as that was concerned. I mean, it was something that I think he felt his opportunities might lie elsewhere. And so, you know, we gave him the opportunity, you know, by releasing him. And we'll go from there. I mean, he did a great job. He was very instrumental, as I said, in the development of this football team. And you know, he will always have a place of high honor here in this organization.
And then I guess I'll give you a chance to maybe respond. He gave a quote to Gentleman's Quarterly saying that he thinks that his play helped throw a wrench into your plans. And it seemed like you actually were quite, you know, happy to use him sometimes. So it was a little bit jarring. What do you say when you hear that quote, Coach?
Well, you know, his site came out and explained that, you know, this was a reporter who didn't quite take it in context, which is fine. And to be honest, I he and I had a great sit down. We had a great conversation after the season was over. And, you know, we talked a little bit about that. And I told him, I said, I honestly don't disagree with you because it was frightening. I told him I was scared to death. I did not know. And he said, you know, Coach, that's fair because there really was no roadmap to us getting to where we were. Which was true. I mean, I didn't know what to expect. And so because of that, you know, there was trepidation on my part. And I told him when he went out there against the Rams and, you know, and he gets sacked for the first time, I had a pit in my stomach. And I literally turned up into the stands and looked at his family because I'm thinking to myself, oh, goodness, you know, what's going on? Because, again, there was no roadmap. Nothing told us, you know, what was going to happen. So there was, I mean, to be honest, to be completely straightforward about this. And as I said, we had a great conversation about it. And he, you know, he and I had a good conversation. We really did.
Okay. So the only real news out of that is Alex Smith's response. Okay, Coach, I get it. We haven't, as far as I know, haven't heard from Alex Smith after all of this.
No, Alex Smith, we just talked about Rivera being accessible to a lot of people. Smith has done that, but he has had no message behind what he's been talking about.
Right.
Like, and he hasn't really I don't want to say shot back because I think that sounds negative, but responded to some of the things that have been said.
It would seem like he'd want to tie this up.
Okay,
we're moving on. he'll have a news conference at some point in Jacksonville, I guess.
Right.
And this will get addressed, but it's still kind of hanging out there.
Yeah.
And also the part about whether or not he could have played in that last playoff game. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think he would have beaten the Bucks if healthy. I think, actually, Taylor Heinicke, with his mobility, actually gave him a better chance to win in that game. But it's still not the feel-good that it was when he first came back. Oh, my God, look what he did, and look what his leg looked like. There's still a little bit of negativity lingering there, a little bit of odor still left in the air from Alex Smith. This is something you may have heard before, but probably not in this much detail, how he got the nickname Riverboat Ron, and it relates to John Madden. So here is the complete, unabridged story of how Ron Rivera became Riverboat Ron.
You know, after my second season, I had this dubious record of being 3-13 of games decided by 6 points or less. And the former owner, Jerry Richardson, had told me, you know, you need a mentor. I have a friend named John Madden, who you know. He said, I've talked with him, and he's waiting to hear from you. So I called Coach, and we started talking, and he said, oh, by the way, before you come see me, you know those 13 games you lost? I said, yeah. He said, go back and look at those games and think about what you could have done differently. So I did. I went back. I looked at those 13 games. I wrote this beautiful report, okay? It's like about 18 pages of details about what I could have done differently and how things could have changed if I had done these different things. So we set an appointment. I fly out to see a coach in his home office in Pleasanton, California. I come in. We sit down. We start talking. And, I mean, it was interesting as heck. So just as we're about to get into the nuts and bolts of our conversation, I say, hey, Coach, I got that report for you. He said, oh, cool. But it's not for me. That's for you. I said, excuse me? He said, that's for you. What did you learn? Well, I said, the biggest thing I learned is I went by the book. He said, you went by the book? What book? I said, well, you know, the one, you know, I mean, you should kick it here in this situation, like, you know, in this game. And, you know, and he said, yeah, how'd it turn out? I said, well, he goes, Ron, forget this book. So go by your gut instinct. You've played enough football. You've coached enough football to go by your gut. Go by how the game feels. Do those things. And so I thought about that. Go back, and now we start the 2013 season, and we're playing Buffalo in Buffalo. And we get in the same situation. And sure enough, I went by the book. We kicked it. Go up by six. They get the ball, drive down, score the touchdown, kicks here to point, and they beat us by one. I was sick. I was ready to throw up on a kid. And everything kept flashing back to what Coach said to me. And so I'm driving home that night, Monday night. I've watched the tape about 10 times, and just I'm just sick. As I'm driving, I'm thinking about this. I run a red light, and I almost get T-boned.
Oh.
And it just wakes me up. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. I get home, and I can't shake it. So the next week we're playing the Giants at home. In our first series, okay, we were 0-2 at that time. In our first series, I go for it twice on fourth down. Both times we convert and score the touchdown. Yeah. And then from that point on, every time we got into a fourth down situation, thinking about down and distance and where we are on the field, we went for it. We went for it. And so as the games progressed, by about the fifth game of the season, I did it again. We played Minnesota in Minnesota on the first series. It's 4-2. We were on a shovel pass to Mike Tolbert. He scores the touchdown. So after the game, some reporter basically writes, boy, Ron Rivera, he went for it. He was gambling like a riverboat gambler. And that's how it was born, Riverboat Ron. And, you know, and it's really not necessarily about just throwing, you know, to the wind as much as it's really thinking about and calculating situations like that.
And that's how Riverboat Ron was born. And that's you won on an 8-game winning streak off of that. And then obviously a couple of Coach of the Year awards after that. And now here you are, the defending NFC East champion head coach of the Washington football team. And I just to dovetail off that just a little bit is what the role of analytics plays now. You see it all the time. I mean, you went for the 2-point conversion in the win against the Giants that almost, you know, when it all came that let the Giants, you know, root heavily for Jalen Hurts against you on Sunday night football in game 256, you know, like, so how, what does that push pull that you deal with? sometimes.
It's about momentum and stuff like that. To me, you know, it's funny because, you know, I've had coaches that I've worked with, mentors like North Turner, and Norv and I have talked about, you know, the right time to go for it on two. You know, like a lot of people say, well, if you're down by 14 and you score, you should go for two now, okay, and on your first score.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you do that, you just got the momentum back, and now you go for two and you miss. Now you've lost the momentum. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, those are the things that Norv and I talked about. And so I've always tried to keep those types of things in mind and how you do it. So really, it's about gut feel to me. I think the analytics are there to really, I guess, just indicate whether or not, you know, this is the right time or this is a good time to do it. You know what I'm saying? Because I've had situations where when we've gone for it with the analytics and it didn't happen out, and I've been told, hey, that's okay, you did what the analytics said. And to me, I struggle with that because if I did what analytics said, and it says 9 times out of 10 you're going to complete it, there's that 1 time out of 10 you don't. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so how do you know if you're going to be that 1 time out of 10 that isn't successful? You know what I'm saying? I mean, if there is no guarantee, you can tell me all you want. Oh, that it's 99%. Hey, that's good. Yeah, but what if you're that 1%? What if that one time it doesn't work? Nobody talks about that until it happens.
Right.
And then it's a bad decision. Uh-huh. No, it's not a bad decision. The numbers, yeah, but the numbers also said. So you just don't know. You can argue it all you want.
Rejecting analytics and going with your gut is good as long as the honeymoon is still on.
Mm-hmm.
And the honeymoon is still on for Ron Rivera. But another couple of under 500 seasons, and you do what you did against the Giants when you went with your gut and went for two and probably should have played for overtime, that's not going to keep you employed. And it caught up with him in Carolina, and I think it would ultimately catch up with him here, no matter the good feel that we have right now. You know, let's see what happens down the line. So clearly he's not a fan of analytics, it sounds like.
No, he's made that argument with reporters before. I think it was in the first month of the season. He had that same exact analogy. Right. And I'll repeat what I said then. To make the argument of the one time versus the other nine is like literally what analytics is about there, Ron. So
they're telling you, yes. Ron, 9 out of 10 times, if you do this, you're going to succeed.
But what about the
other
time?
Right.
Yes, it could happen. That's why some of us are not big gamblers.
That's right.
But if you're going to have the name Riverboat Ron, aren't you going to play the percentages? Isn't that what gambling is all about?
Right, exactly. And you know what happened, too? After that Giants game, we all criticized that decision to say you probably should have played for overtime. But, hey, this is what we're living with right now, right? Guess what, Ron? We do the same thing if you take the analytics. And you know what you say after the game? Well, the analytics said 9 out of 10 times we made it. We just didn't do it that time. And I think everyone would actually be like, yep, that's how it is these days.
Yeah.
So, and analytics has taken over sports.
Every sport.
It's killing baseball right now. But the analytics say, don't worry about striking out, because when you hit a home run, it has a much bigger impact than if you slap a single down the line. So that's just the world we're living in right now. Anyway, the Madden stories that he told, this is the 85th birthday of John Madden, and there's a very good piece written by Ryan Hockensmith at ESPN.com about stories of Madden over his life. A couple of really fascinating things. One, when he first started broadcasting, so he left the Raiders after the 79 season. They had won the Super Bowl in 76, or 78. So he coached like 2 more years after they won the Super Bowl, and he stepped away. He was still a young man, and he didn't know what he was going to do. He thought he'd hang out with his family. Well, he went home, and his family said, no, well, we've managed to live without you for a long time, so no, we're not going to hang out with you. So he got himself into broadcasting, and obviously became legendary at that. But he was the first to say to the producers, yeah, I'd like to watch practice. And they said, no, we don't watch practice. Oh, no, I need to watch practice. And he started what is now standard in the industry, that the announcers go and watch practice a couple of days before the game. He had entree to that because he was a coach and he knew all of those guys. Most of the guys who had gone into broadcasting before him had been former players, and they also didn't take it, I guess, as seriously as he did. and that he really wanted to know what was going on. He wanted to see the practice field. That was that. The other thing was, he said they're sitting in a production meeting, it's like early 90s, and he just says out of the blue, you know, we ought to have a yellow line there to show where the first down is.
Wow.
And the initial reaction from the producers was, oh, no, 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 no. John, you're a coach. You don't understand broadcasting. That will distract the viewers.
Oh, Yeah.
Within 2 years, here comes the yellow line. And now you're watching a game. You go, where's the yellow line? Where is it?
Right, where's the marker?
Yeah, where is it? And Joe Jacoby told me this story. Joe's last year was 93. And his wife is not a huge fan, though she's learned a lot about football watching
sure.
Joe over the years. And he said they were watching a game when it first came in. And his wife said, you know, Joe, I used to go to all the games, and I never saw that on the field when you were playing. They also told the story of how Madden got started. There was a guy by the name of Trip Hawkins who had the idea for Madden, and he wanted to pitch it to Madden. So he went to his agent, Sandy Montag, and he said, I want to make the pitch. He said, well, this is when Madden was still traveling by train for the Madden Cruiser. He said, there's a 3-day trip where he's going to be on a train from Denver to Los Angeles. Why don't you get on at Denver? We'll arrange it, and you'll have a meeting with him. And he said they talked for 3 days about this Madden game. And at the time, Hawkins said, well, we don't have enough room on the screen to have 11 players for each team. We're going to do 7-on-7. Madden said, it's not football. Needs to be 11-on-11. Said, well, that'll take years to, you know, put into technology. And he said, I'll wait. Well, they got it done in 2 years. He negotiated a deal for $100,000 in cash and 5% of sales.
Oh, my gosh.
And since 1988, the game has sold 130 million copies. He made far more money from that game than he did in his years of coaching and television combined. He's got to have hundreds of millions of dollars off of this.
Not only that, Andy, in today's day and age, it is the only licensed NFL video game, period.
Yeah, right.
That's it. It's the one. And they just re-upped for like another 5 or 10 years or whatever it was with the Players Association. They're the only game in town, literally. So
and Gus Johnson does it now, right?
Yeah, he's on the announce. It's him and I want to say Collinsworth is still on there, but I haven't bought Madden in about five years. But
the last time Madden was on Madden has to be 10 years, 12 years. More than that.
10 or 12 years. Yeah, you're about right there. Yeah it's been a while.
Yeah, that's crazy. Here's another Madden story. There's like 20 stories in here. Here's another good one. There, he's having breakfast with his agent Sandy Montag in Chicago. A guy walks up with a thick British accent and says that he lives in the UK and that they rotate the network games there. They show one a week. 1 week it's a CBS game, 1 week it's a Fox game. And he said, but I only watch the games you're on, John. And Madden said, oh, thank you very much. Guy walks away. He's out of earshot. And Madden says to his agent, Sandy Montag, that guy had big glasses and a big attitude. He goes, yeah, it's Elton John.
Wow.
And the other one I picked out was from September 11, 2001, when, of course, we had the attacks. And Peggy Fleming was in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. She lived in Los Angeles. Maybe she still does. And like everybody else, was stranded there because flights were shut down for over a week. And she wanted to get back home, but she didn't want to rent a car and drive across the country. And somehow her agent connected her with John Madden. And Madden is in New York, and he's getting ready to drive back across country in the Madden Cruiser to Los Angeles. And he gets a hold of her, or she gets a hold of him, and he says, hey, I'll pick you up. They drive the Madden Cruiser to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. He honks outside the hotel. She comes out and gets on the bus, and they spent 52 hours, it said, because that's amazing that they can get the bus across the country that fast.
Yeah,
they had two drivers. And he said they spent the next couple of days hanging out on the bus and have become lifelong friends.
That's awesome.
And, you know, famous meets famous. And you'd never make a connection between Peggy Fleming, who won gold medals in ice skating in 1968, and John Madden, who at that time was an enormous football celebrity.
Yeah.
So it's good. It's a good read. Very good stuff on John Madden, who, and this shows you, too, how quickly fame fades once you get out of the spotlight. Because I would think if you were to ask a 12, 13-year-old kid today, who's John Madden, he would say, oh, that's the guy who does the video game.
I wouldn't even say they know it's a person, honestly, because he's not really – I don't think he's shown in the video game either anymore, as far as I know.
Yeah.
So it would be – that's the video game. That's
but they would have no recollection of him as an announcer.
No.
And
no
he
shot.
Was as yeah. big as it ever got
yeah.
in announcing. And you will probably say, oh, I don't have any recollection of this, but I remember him as a coach.
Yeah,
and he was
right.
and he while he had this personality – it wasn't the big thing until he retired and became an announcer. And then he was huge and because he used his hands. And then there was the light beer commercials, which, again, are too old for you to remember. But that was a big part of the sports culture, too, because you can't have active athletes or even, at that time, coaches advertise alcohol. Mm-hmm. So they had all these ex-jocks and ex-coaches doing this, and he became one of the big stars of that. And one of the commercials was he would burst through this banner throwing his hands open, you know, hey, I don't know. And so, yeah, so anyway. John Madden, happy birthday, yeah. and has been in the consciousness for so long. He became head coach of the Raiders when he was 32 years old. Yeah, he was that bright and that well thought of by Al Davis, the owner of the team. 45 years ago today, All the President's Men released. Talk about a movie that changed the lives of a lot of people. We'll talk about it next. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630.
The Andy Pollin Hour on ESPN 630, the sports capital.
In for Tony Kornheiser as well today from 11 to 12, and we'll talk to Mel Kiper at 11:20 this morning. It was 45 years ago today that All the President's Men was released. It is one of the great movies of all time. It was selected for preservation in the U.S. National Film Registry by the Library of Congress in 2010 as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Very significant in my life. I had a great American history teacher in the 10th grade, and we studied American history from the Revolutionary War through what was happening at that time, towards the end of the year. So by June, we're studying Watergate. Well, Watergate is unfolding. Nixon didn't resign until a couple of months later in August. So we're learning about this. And by the time I'm getting ready to graduate in 1976, this movie comes out. And it's incredible for somebody who was I was already interested in journalism. But, I mean, just an unbelievable movie. And the romanticism of what was happening with reporters, you know, they did show the drudgery of what they had to go through. And there were no computers there. So there's this great scene where they go to the Library of Congress and they're going through stacks and stacks of cards, which now, you know, you just have to Google a name, yep. be in there. There's no cell phones, anything like that. Yeah. So it's a totally different time. And the flow of news is incredible because it's all dependent on a daily newspaper. So you've got to wait till the following day until the actual physical paper hits yep. your doorstep to know what's going on. That's how incredible this story was at that time, given you know where we are now. So I look at this movie now, and it's still great to watch. It's got unbelievable stars in it, in Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman, who played Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. I think Hoffman more resembles Bernstein than Redford resembles Woodward, though handsome fellow, Bob Woodward for sure. And so Woodward produced the movie. He bought the script for the book rights. The book came out first. He bought that for $450,000. The movie grossed $70 million, which in those days is a lot of money. The character actors who are in this, it's like a who's who. Jack Warden played Harry Rosenfield. I went to school with Harry's daughter, one of his daughters. He had two. And my parents actually bought Harry's house before he left to go work in New York. Martin Balsam plays Howard Simmons. Hal Holbrook, who just passed away, plays Deep Throat. And we didn't know who Deep Throat was until about 10 years ago, as Mark Felt, who was with the CIA. Some said he actually didn't exist. And he came forward just before his death and said, yeah, I'm Deep Throat there. James Jane Alexander is in this. She's been in a bunch of movies. Stephen Collins, same thing. Ned Beatty. Meredith Baxter from Family Ties. Very young there. F. Murray Abraham, very good actor. And Polly Holiday, who is in this show called Alice on TV. Kiss My Grits. You know, yeah, that was her. I mean, all kinds of people came out of this. But it's just an unbelievable look at journalism at its best. And all that went on in the most incredible journalism story we've ever had in the United States. The movie was nominated for all kinds of awards. It did not win the Academy Award. Rocky did. But Jason Robards won Best Supporting Actor. And I know people who work with Ben Bradley at The Washington Post and swear that they are doubles, including Bob Woodward, who did this interview with CBS a few years ago, talking about Jason Robards playing Ben Bradley.
Robards playing Bradley, it's like they're twins. And one of the fascinating stories is when they were making the movie, and who do we get to play Bradley? Well, director Alan Pakula and the actors knew Robards and said, you know, there's something about them that's the same. So they called Robards in and they gave him the script and said, we're going to pay you $50,000 to play Bradley. And at this point, Robards was at a low point in his career. He had a drinking problem. Wow, $50,000. Took the script home, brought it back, and said, I can't play Bradley. And said, why? Well, read the script. All he does is run around and say, where's the effing story? And they said to him, look, that's what the editor of the Washington Post does.
They give him a line in the movie, Robards, where he says, I can't do the reporting for my reporters, which means I have to trust them, and I hate trusting anybody. Was that Bradley?
Yeah, that was Bradley. He knew that reporters were extension of him, so he was there was always the Bradley interrogation when you had a story that was high risk, unnamed sources, particularly during Watergate, and it was careful, and it was never hostile. It was, hey, look, we're on the same team. I'm just trying to check and make sure you've done enough.
What about the great scene in the movie at night outside what is supposed to be his house, and he's there in his pajamas and robe talking to two guys playing you? What was that, anything like the truth?
Well, that's interesting. First of all, it happened. We were told that Watergate was going to explode. Nixon was involved. And clearly at this point the dimensions were much greater than anyone expected. So at that moment, you don't follow the chain of command. As my colleague Carl Bernstein wisely said, we called Bradley at 2 a.m. in the morning and said, we got to come see you. And so we went to see him, and we were told that, you know, there could be a lot of wiretapping, so we asked him to come out on his front lawn, and I think he thought we'd finally gone batty. And we told him about the extent of what Watergate was now. And he, in the movie version, he says, okay, go take a bath, get back to work. Nothing's at stake other than the First Amendment, freedom of the press, and the future of the country. That was Hollywood. That literally did not happen. What Ben said, and this is a case where the truth is sometimes better, after we told him, he looked at us and he said, what the hell do we do now?
Which is probably what most people would say in that situation. But Ben Bradley, he's a supporting actor. The Jason Robards playing that character. But the movie really centers around what he does. And it's just a great, great film. I can't say that enough times. And in my same year of graduating high school, Christine Brennan and Mike Wilbon graduated the same year, and Kevin Blackstone was a year later. All of them have gone on to work for the Post, And they are just examples of people who saw this movie and were so influenced by it. I don't know if it changed the course of where they were going, though. Christine said it really did. I mean, she was going to go to Northwestern anyway, but she knew that's what she was going to do after that movie. And I just look at that and how it influenced generations and generations of reporters, people who really didn't have an understanding of what it could be. Now, for most people who get into the business, you're covering local school boards and things like that. It's drudgery. But every once in a while, you stumble into a major story. You don't get a story like this. This is a once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-100-years type of story. But the way it was reported by the Washington Post changed the course of history. It really did. I mean, to think that they were able to connect a break-in into Democratic headquarters to the President of the United States and ultimately lead to his resignation, unbelievable. Just unbelievable. And the movie has just done so well. All the President's Men came out 45 years ago. Please tell me you saw it.
Yeah, we watched it. Same thing in high school.
Good.
My junior year, I believe.
Good.
Yeah.
Instructive. Did it influence you to get into this sort of business or not?
Not really. Yeah. I enjoyed it, though. Yeah. I mean, like, it's hard not to enjoy.
What we do here is not journalism.
Right.
It's not journalism. Yeah. Don't mistake that. And anybody who does this and tells you it is, he or she is lying. It's not what it is. Coming up, oh boy, what do you hear with LeVar Arrington dropped the other day? We'll get to that. Mel Kiper next hour as well, as I sit in for Tony. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.